Thank you. I didn't even notice. Draw near, hold fast, press on. That's on the title slide. Whoa. That's crazy. It's all connected. Yes. Maybe this is going to help connecting more to what Jochen's question was. In the hold fast section, we are going to talk specifically about hope and what the author of Hebrews says about hope in the last section, the press on. I'm just doing the press on so it fits the whole thing, you know? Draw, hold, press. But really, it should be press one another, like press on. Or some translations use spur one another or other things, but I don't like spurs. I've only ridden a horse one time in my life, and it was a bad experience. Don't ask me about that experience in the question and answer section. This isn't question and answer yet. Don't ask me about the horse experience. What we're going to talk about now is the most famous chapter of the book of Hebrews. Citation needed. Who knows? Who can judge what the most famous chapter is? But probably everybody here who's been in the church for a while has heard some sort of reference to this, if not a full-blown sermon on Hebrews chapter 11. And with all due respect to the guy who divided up the scriptures into chapters and verses, whose name was Stephen Langton in the English language, he lived from 1150 to 1228. He was the one-time Archbishop of Canterbury. I don't think that he was so divinely inspired as he divided up the chapters, because sometimes the ways that he broke up the chapters are just not that inspiring. And we should definitely, definitely keep the first three verses of chapter 12 in the context of all of chapter 11. So, to find out more of what I mean, let us read chapter 11 together. And Lord, help us to understand these as we read these words. Amen. Now, faith is confidence in what we hope for, and assurance about what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. By faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. By faith Abel brought God a better offering than Cain did. By faith he was commended as righteous when God spoke well of his offerings. And by faith Abel still speaks, even though he is dead. By faith, Enoch was taken from this life so that he did not experience death. He could not be found because God had taken him away. For before he was taken, he was commended as one who pleased God. And without faith, it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. By faith, Noah, when warned about things not yet seen, in holy fear built an ark to save his family. By faith, he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness that is in keeping with faith. By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. And by faith, even Sarah, who was past childbearing age, was enabled to bear children because she considered him faithful who had made the promise. And so from this one man, as he, as good as dead, came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as countless as the sand on the seashore. All these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting that they were foreigners and strangers on earth. People who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. If they had been thinking of the country they had left, they would have had opportunity to return. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. By faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had embraced the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, "It is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned." Abraham reasoned that God could even raise the dead, and so, in a manner of speaking, he did receive Isaac back from death. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau in regard to their future. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons and worshipped as he leaned on the top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions concerning the burial of his bones. By faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born because they saw he was no ordinary child and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter, chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered because he saw him who is invisible. By faith, he kept the Passover and the application of blood so that the destroyer of the firstborn would not touch the firstborn of Israel. By faith, the people passed through the Red Sea as on dry land, but when the Egyptians tried to do so, they were drowned. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell after the army had marched around them for 7 days. By faith, the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient. And what more shall I say? I do not have time to tell about Gideon, Barak, Samson, and Jephthah, about David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of the flames, and escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned to strength, and who became powerful in battle and routed foreign armies. Women received back their dead, raised to life again. There were others who were tortured, refusing to be released so that they might gain an even better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging and even chains and imprisonment. They were put to death by stoning. They were sawed in two. They were killed by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, and mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains, living in caves and in holes in the ground. These were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised, since God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us would they be made perfect. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. That's Hebrews 11 and the first three verses of chapter 12. And for the Bodenseehof student who has been caught up with his or her Bible reading, they're going, yeah, let's go. I remember that one. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yes, 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 yes. And some of you said yes. By faith. It occurs 18 times in this chapter, in this section, by faith. Obviously, repetition being quite an important thing in this type of communication. It is the emphasis. There's a reason that we call this the Hall of Faith, talking about all of these people. Now, we've talked a little bit about some definitions of faith. The author of Hebrews gives a definition of faith right at the beginning of this section. We see it. Faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. That's the very first sentence in this passage. Faith is one of those nebulous words that we don't always know how to wrap our minds around. We've talked about this a little bit in a chapel, but as a by way of reminder, and or for those who weren't there for that chapel, there's a few different ways that we could translate this word faith. One is allegiance, that is allying yourself with somebody, right? Being in some sort of connection or covenant with that. One of the Hebrew words that talks about this idea, we often translate as love or steadfast love, but it's the word chesed. It's a really important word in the Hebrew Bible, and it's got this idea of covenantal faithfulness or loyal love. That's kind of being evoked here, I think. Trust, this is a word that we use much more. I think, you know, maybe there's a translation out there. I'm not aware of any translation. If I were just to make the simplest one-for-one switch, I would have said trust in all of those passages, all 18 times, instead of by faith, which is just kind of like this, oh, this philosophical idea of like believing sort of that God exists, right? We could throw belief up there as well, right? Because belief, faith, and trust all come from the same word in Greek. That's the word pistis or pistuo is the verb form. And it's about trust, right? I recognize trust. Trust is what my child needs to jump into my arms in the swimming pool. They have to trust that I can catch them. So maybe we could say by trust, by trust, by trust, by trust. Or faithfulness or trustworthiness. These are all words that maybe are a little more helpful to grasp what the idea of faith is getting at. Rachel, what's her name? Botsman. She's a global trust expert, which means companies pay her a lot of money to like help them build trust. She just says this is a totally secular perspective. Trust is a confident relationship with the unknown. That's kind of quite similar, actually, to what we saw in the first few verses of this section. Trust is a confident relationship with the unknown, right? That's why faith is necessary, but one day will go away in the new creation. Because we do have some things that are unknown. There are things about God that are unknown. We see as though through a glass darkly. There are things about our futures and even our present circumstances that are unknown. And so we have to live by faith. And the emphasis on Hebrews chapter 11 is really talking about these people who are living their lives. They're living for a country that they can't see. They're living for, they know what they've come from, and yet to step out into the unknown takes trust. What Rachel Botsman was talking about is how in the corporate world, we often kind of talk about, oh, it's all about transparency, right? Making sure everybody knows all of the details of all of the org charts, and actually transparency, people often think that transparency builds trust. But it doesn't. Transparency actually breeds suspicion over time. It leads to mistrust because you have less unknown. What we want to do is maybe what some people would call virtue ethics, where you build relationships of trust based on people proving themselves trustworthy. There has to be unknown in order for there to be faith. Sometimes we think that courage is the opposite of fear, but it's not. Courage is not the opposite of fear. Fear must be present. You need courage to overcome fear, but the opposite of fear is faith. The opposite of fear, right? So maybe we define it the way Rachel Botsman would define it. Fear is a mistrusting relationship with the unknown. Faith is a trusting relationship with the unknown. Fear must be present in order for you to have courage, but faith is how you overcome fear. Why faith? That's a question that I have. Why faith? Saved by grace, through faith, why faith? Why does that have to be unknown? Why can't that be a known thing? That's a question I have. Anyone else ever had that question? I have an idea. I don't have a Bible verse for this, but this is my idea from my experience. And that is, relationships based on trust are greater than relationships based on knowledge. The only way I can illustrate this is with personal example. If my relationship with Catherine was based purely on knowledge, which is to say that I have to know exactly what she's doing and where she is at all times, that is not a good relationship. That's what? That's called stalking. That's called manipulative boyfriend, husband, right? But there's something, you know, you think about it this way, kind of coming at this from the opposite angle. What is there to gain from a relationship that is not based on knowledge, but is based on some level of unknown? What is to gain, I think, is that Catherine can, when we have a relationship of mutual trust and mutual submission, then we can be individuals, we can delight one another and surprise one another. If I don't know what Catherine is doing at all hours of the day, what happens is, and this actually happens sometimes, and it's like the favorite, my favorite thing in my life. If Catherine just disappears for several hours, you know, if I don't have a trusting relationship with her, I could get really paranoid and start freaking out. But if Catherine disappears for several hours and I have no idea what she's doing and she's unreachable and, you know, she turns off her iPhone tracking and so I'm like, where'd she go? Sometimes I come home and there's cake or cookies or something delightful, right? Is that worth the risk? I say yes. Yes, it's worth the risk. Because I totally trust Catherine. And because I have a relationship with her that's based on trust, we have a great, spontaneous, delightful, we're both individual relationship where there can be mutual trust and mutual surprise and delight and individuality. That's the kind of relationship I think God wants to have with us. He wants to have, or not that, you know, we disappear and we can surprise him with cake, but he allows us to be our own individuals. He allows us to do our thing, to live our lives, to pursue our passions and do that in connection with him, in trusting connection with him. And he also can surprise us and delight us. We pray so often that God would reveal his will to us every single step of the corner. If he showed me everything right now, just downloaded all the information about all of the things that I'm going to experience in the rest of my life, and I knew that right now, guess what? I would never be surprised again. I would never have the joy of finding some wonderful new corner of creation again. Oh, God, please do not reveal all of your will to me right now. Please just delight me with something tomorrow. A few more notes on this passage. Just some notes because there's really a lot here. We could spend a lot of time, but here's one thing we often miss. In verse 11:3, we see that the beginning of this whole hall of faith is talking about God creating the universe. By faith, we understand that the universe was formed at God's command. The end of this, and this is why we should not separate chapters 11 from chapters 12, we see that it's Jesus who's running run ahead of us. He's marked out the race for us, and he's the pioneer and the perfecter of our faith. It's by faith that we understand God created everything, and it's by faith that God, that Jesus has marked out the whole race, right? So God is literally the beginning and the end, the Alpha and the Omega of faith, and of all of the redemptive history of the Old Testament on into the New Testament. It starts with God, it ends with Jesus. It's all centered on the faithfulness, the trustworthiness of God. In 11:4, we see this section. These are just a few notes on the text of things that often confuse us or just things that are noteworthy. By faith, Abel brought God a better offering than Cain did. When you read this section in Genesis 4, we don't know why God's accepting Abel's sacrifice and not Cain's. But here, the author of Hebrews is giving some sort of interpretation, some sort of indication. Maybe it was about the condition of the heart. Maybe it wasn't so much that God likes meat and not vegetables. But it's really about how they did it. And I think a clue for us that sacrifice has always been about the condition of the heart, right? Jesus says, sorry, not Jesus. Where is this? Is this Joel? person who has this for the prophet presentation, Joel says, rend your hearts, not your garments. Yeah? Joel, what verse is that, Joel? Joel 2:12. Rend your hearts, not your garments, right? We have these indications all throughout the Old Testament, and it's clearly here. What God is interested in is the condition of your heart, not your outward external experience. We could name lots of other examples in the Old Testament and the New Testament of that reality. But I think it's from right off the bat, this offering of Cain and Abel. He's interested in the heart. 11 verse 6, let's just read that together. Without faith, it's impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and rewards those who earnestly seek him. There was a book that I read when I was 18 or 19 years old, I think 18 years old, called True Faced. It's a book that I brought here to Germany, and I lent it to a student named Hannah Lenuick. She never returned it. She never returned my book. No, she actually did this year. But she has loaned that book to so many people. I know that some of you she has loaned that book to. She loaned that my book out. It's not even in print anymore. She keeps loaning my very precious, not in print book anymore to so many people. And I'm not bitter about it at all. I've forgiven her, or I will one day. But there's actually, it is sort of in print. There's sort of a sequel called The Cure. Anyway, True-Faced. It presents this picture of a road diverging in the woods, like the Robert Frost poem. And one path takes you to this one room, which is called the path of pleasing God. And one path takes you to this room called the path and the room of trusting God. And the question of the book is, which is better, to take the path of pleasing God, to take the path of trusting God? When I read that book, when I was 18, I was fully into the, oh, well, obviously the right path is pleasing God. Trust is like great, bonus, but pleasing God is what the Christian life is all about. It was not a dissimilar experience to me to reading with for the first time and just going like, for God, seems right to me. Yeah, that's right. That's what a good Christian does. I should have read, and I had read this at this point, but I hadn't paid attention to it. I should have read Hebrews 11:6. You can't please God without trusting God. That's just the way that God has made the fabric of the universe. When we trust God, that enables us to please him. Trying to live your life for God, pleasing him, getting him to like you, will not work. What works is trusting God, trusting Jesus' sacrifice being valid for you, trusting that God has accepted you, trusting the resurrection in the dead, which is the next point. According to 11:19, somehow mysteriously, Abraham trusted as he sacrificed Isaac. That's the interpretation of the author of Hebrews says he somehow trusted in the resurrection, that God would give him his son back. Now, exactly what Abraham knew about bodily resurrection, we don't know. Maybe he thought, well, we don't know, right? There's lots of things he could have thought. But somehow, according to the author of Hebrews, he was trusting that his son would come back, even if he killed him. And here's a statement that's worth banking on. God's promises are more certain than death. Because of the resurrection, God's promises are more certain than death. Trusting in the resurrection is the stupidest thing you can do, unless it's true. Trusting in the resurrection is the most foolish thing that you can do. Paul says this in 1 Corinthians 15. We're the most pitiable fools if there is no resurrection from the dead. But because there is, then it's the greatest thing we can do, is to trust in the resurrection. That's what enables you to live a hard day. That's what enables you to live a hard year. That's what enables you, if this is the call of God in your life, to face any difficulty or whatever difficulty it is, and we all will face difficulties, then trusting the resurrection is what enables us to get through the day or the year or the life. And the last little point would be 11:26. On BSP, sometimes I'll write when someone is saying, like, Joshua or Moses said to Jesus, you know, in a prayer or something, and I'll write, anachronism! That's wrong! That's so bad! Ah, tisk, tisk. Jesus didn't exist yet. Jesus wasn't born yet. They were talking to God. They were talking to Yahweh. They were talking to whatever. But then I look at the book of Hebrews, and it says that Moses did this for the sake of Christ, verse 26. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt. And I go, author of Hebrews, this is an anachronism. Jesus wasn't born yet. Christ wasn't born yet. There wasn't even, besides the one in Genesis 49 and 50, there wasn't even like messianic language yet. Tisk, tisk, author of Hebrews. But somehow, the interpretation of the author of Hebrews, and this maybe is a model for us to be a little more loose with our interpretations of the Old Testament, at times, without going off the rails, of course, going into anachronism central, to be able to say, oh yeah, in this mysterious, mystical way, when we did something for God, for the sake of God, or even when we did something that turned out in the fullness of time, in the plan of God, sovereignty of God, to work out God's salvation, then it is like doing it for Christ. One of the big questions that I have when it comes to Hebrews chapter 11 is, how the heck are these people called saints? Now, I'm down with the Moses stuff, you know, heck of a guy, most humble guy that ever lived. He said so himself, you know. But Old Testament saints, Gideon, Saint Gideon, I don't know. How is Gideon's life a life characterized by faith? He was the least of trusting person I think I see. Samson? The guy's life was a train wreck. Samson, like, systematically broke all of the laws that he possibly could. It says it in verse 32. I don't have time to tell about Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah. Oh, right. Jephthah? Come on! Jephthah. I almost went full Seinfeld on that. Come on, Jephthah! What the heck is Jephthah doing in the Hall of Faith? No! When I get exasperated, I go full Seinfeld. These are not examples of faith. These are examples of God's triumph through our weakness and tragedy and train wrecks, right? These are the people who lived by faith. That's these people are questionable at best. And maybe this is a thread to pull. I don't know how far to go with this, but it seems like, at least in the Hall of Faith, they are being presented by the author of Hebrews as something that they did on their best day and not on their worst day, right? One moment of faithfulness, leaving your father's country. Did Abraham have things that he messed up? Oh, yeah, all the time. Did David have things that he messed up? All the time, right? But God did see the faithfulness that they pulled. And yet, the emphasis of Hebrews, and this is why we can't separate Hebrews 12:1-3 from Hebrews 11, the emphasis is actually on God's faithfulness. Maybe you could even read this whole section in reverse and say, by faith, the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell. By faith, the people passed through the Red Sea on dry land. Maybe it's not entirely or even mostly about their faith, but about God's faith. By God's faith, by God's trustworthiness, by God's covenant, by God's allegiance, these people did all these things. Grammatically, it's ambiguous. And I think there is this play, this dance that's happening, where it's like you see their faithfulness in response to God's faithfulness, but beginning and the end, the faith that really counts is God's faith. I was asked a question one time from a student named Hannah. Not Hannah Lenwick. It was a different Hannah. It was the year of the five Hannahs. It was the year of the five Bens and the year of the five Hannahs. There were five Bens and five Hannahs one year. It was really easy. In the first 2 weeks, when you didn't know someone's name, you just guessed Ben. You had, if it was a man, and Hannah, if it was a woman, and you had like a 20% chance of being right. It was awesome. So, Hannah comes up to me after I'd done some lecture, and she says, "Is there grace in the Old Testament?" With the implication that there was zero grace in the Old Testament. Grace was an invention that Jesus thought of. And there's a lot to unpack there, but the irony of this was that her name is Hannah. And Hannah is the Hebrew word for grace. There's grace all over the Old Testament. All of Hebrews chapter 11 is story of grace after grace after grace after grace after grace. All throughout the Old Testament, all throughout the history of God, you do see the grace of God over and over again. And so I think the implication maybe is kind of an argument like, because remember, this is not just like some theoretical theological tome. This is a letter to encourage Christians. If Gideon could do it, you can do it. If Samson could do it, you can do it. If Jephthah could do it, you can do it. If God can use David in the midst of all of his failures and foibles, God can use you. Hold on. Hold on. Keep going. Press on. Draw near. For Abraham was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. All these people were still living by faith when they died. They didn't receive the things promised. Yeah, things are hard. Things are hard in life. Guess what? Abraham didn't see the thousands upon thousands upon millions of descendants. He didn't see that, and it's very, very, very likely that you won't see the fruit, and you definitely won't see the full fruit of your life, of your ministry, of your good acts that you do in the name of God, of those good things that God has prepared for you. All of these people just lived by faith, meaning they didn't see what they were doing. They just had to have this trusting relationship with the unknown, with the future, lay it in God's hands, trust that somehow God can do that, can use this. Keep going, keep loving other people, keep doing, keep showing up, just trusting that I might not even see these things that are going to be good. They're looking for a different country, a country that they'll never even see, longing for a heavenly city, knowing that more likely than not, they're going to die before they see it. And that's the same for you and me. It's worth it, the author of Hebrews says. It's worth it. Just hold on. Just keep going. All of those things, you disregard the treasures of this world, there's something to look forward to, a reward to look forward to. Ultimately, all of us are looking beyond to what Christ is going to be making. All of us are saved by grace through faith. It's Christ's gift. That's what the word grace means, gift. It's Christ's gift. That gift is only going to be finally realized in the future. And we draw near to God. We keep showing up in our relationship with God, keep showing up in our relationship with others, confessing as we see that we have sinned, knowing that the sins are taken away by the gift of God, and the promised future is the gift of God. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, to draw near, to turn around, draw near. For he's set a day when he'll judge this world with justice by the man he's appointed. He's given proof of this to everyone by raising him from the dead. Paul is teaching in that context. Paul's teaching in Athens, a missionary message to non-Jews. And he's saying all the history of the of the Jewish story, God was overlooking ignorance for all of the various people, tribes, and people all over the world. God was overlooking their ignorance, but once you've heard this message of Jesus, you cling to the message of Jesus. I don't know how far to take that, how far to go with that. The question of what about those who have never heard? You know, what about the Sawi tribe before Don Richardson ever came to go to those people? Did Don Richardson accidentally condemn anyone that he brought the message of Jesus to by telling them about the story of Jesus? We've got all sorts of hypothetical theological knots we can tie ourselves into. What I appreciated about the book, The Peace Child, and I really can recommend that as a book to read, is one of the things that Don Richardson said is there is sometimes there's criticism for the missionaries of that particular age of going to those people and with it bringing colonialism and whatever. And what he said was, look, colonialism was coming for the Sawi people no matter what. What we wanted to do was we wanted to get there first to tell them the good news of Jesus and to prepare them for the inevitable Dutch invasion. No offense to the Dutch people, but that was just the history, the time and place in history. The Dutch invasion that was going to colonialize them and abuse them for profit eventually anyway. So he said, we wanted to reach them with the love of Christ before the world came crashing down on them. So I don't know how far to go with the whole God overlooked certain people groups in certain times and certain eras of human history, overlooked their ignorance. But what is clear enough is what Paul dedicated his life to is bringing the good news of Jesus, utilizing the Roman roads and the Roman trading routes to bring the good news of Jesus to as many people as possible before he died. And in that way, he was looking to a better country, looking for a better reward, and trying to bring that reward, that blessing of life here today and in the future to as many people as possible. Loving his neighbor. Trusting the resurrection. Encouragement to face even death in the midst of faith unto death, being able to trust that Jesus' resurrection is better. And finally, the climax of the climax of this section is Hebrews 12, 1 through 3. We'll read it again. Therefore, since we, Christians, are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer, the perfecter of faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. From the first to the last, Jesus brings all of our hopes to this triumphant conclusion. Jesus' crucifixion in the Gospels is being pictured as his enthronement. And of course, for the book of Hebrews, his ascension is central to being raised up that we might see him and run our eyes. As the commentator Greg Keister said, it was common in the ancient Greco-Roman world for a Greek runner to fix his gaze as they ran the last lap of a marathon was to run around sort of a track, and so everyone could watch the runners coming in. And right at the finish line was seated the emperor on his throne in the seat of honor. And so the Greek runners would run into the stadium, and what they would do is they would fix their eyes on the emperor and run toward the finish line. That's the picture here. Fix your eyes on Jesus. Keep running. It's been a long race. In some ways, we can all say that it's the final stretch of a long, long, long race of human history. We don't know how long it is. Catherine one time likened being pregnant to a marathon where you get to the due date, and then all of a sudden you find out that the finish line is not the finish line. There's an indeterminate finish line in the next 2 weeks. Beside the point. But what Jesus does, he's kind of like Samwise Gamgee. He can't carry it for us, but he can carry us. He carries us across the finish line. When we fix our eyes on him, he carries us across the finish line. He deals with all of the evil. He casts the ring into the fires of Mordor. Why? Look at verse 2 again. For the joy. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross. Why is it joy to die on a cross? It's joy because the Father received children. It's the joy because on the cross, the Spirit received a home. We're called his temple. And it's joy for Jesus to die on the cross because the Son received a bride. That's the joy of the cross. The Father receives sons and daughters, adopts us into his family, and all the blessings that come with that. The Spirit receives a home, and the Son receives a bride. That's the church. So let's end with a non-rhetorical question. Would love to hear from you guys. What's your way, practically, of fixing your eyes on Jesus in life? We can just encourage each other with things that we do, things that we strive to do, things that we might hypothetically do to be able to fix our eyes in Jesus in this life and run the race. It's non-rhetorical.
One of the main ways I practically fix my eyes on Jesus is when I've got like a thought that's like running in my head that's like dragging me down, I'll bring it right to Jesus and I'll just be like, oh, God, this is really bothering me. I'm just going to give that to you. Take that away from me.
Thank you. Yeah. Opening up the line of conversation with the Lord as you have that. And just being honest with the thoughts that you have, not heaping shame and shame and guilt on top of yourself when you have a thought, but being honest. I try to live my life like Reb Tevye from The Fiddler on the Roof, you know? He's just walking, milking the cows, and he goes, Lord, you made many poor people. I realize, of course, it's no shame to be poor, but it's no great honor either. So what would have been so terrible if you'd have granted me a small fortune? If I were a rich man, rather be de be de be de be de be de be de bum. All day long I'd be de be de bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. Ba ba de be de be de be de be de be de be bum. All right, so what are other ways that you can, you know, 9 o'clock, right? Other ways that you practically fix your eyes on Jesus? We'll cut that out of the recording, don't worry.
Actually, look at the birds.
Oh. Yeah, you could fix your eyes on Jesus by looking at the birds.
I haven't done this so well here, but at home a lot, I would put little stick-it notes of like verses that are good reminders near places that I would like be a lot and look at often.
Yeah, thank you. Reminders.
When I had like early morning basketball practice, I would make a point to not turn on music and just drive in silence and like pray and listen to God.
Thank you. Yeah.
Just taking a walk with Jesus, like going outside and talking out loud to him. People might think you're crazy, but it's really helpful.
Leaning on his understanding and acknowledging him.
Yeah.
I think in a way, like not just including him in your thought, or like not just like having conversation with him, but including him in your thoughts and including him in, like just thinking of him as you'd think of, as of a friend or somebody that you love.
Yeah. Good. I think most of those things have been individual things. We can also think about the things that we can do communally as well. I think of Ephesians 5:12, that we sing songs, hymns of praise and spiritual songs. We can do that in our car, of course. We can do that in community, and we do that in community here at Bones Health. But all of those things that you've just said, and many, many more, we could go on much longer, I think. All of those things I would put in the category of we get to do those things. Maybe even for some of those, it's we should do those things. But it's not we must do those things. This is what saves us, right? It's these are things that can lead us into this deep rest, this deep sense of playfulness and joy that we have with the Lord. And that it can, you know, on a psychological level, it can reduce cortisol levels, proven. But on a much, much deeper level, it's building the relationship. It's investing in the relationship of trust that we get to have. It's drawing near. It's simply drawing near. Drawing near with faith. Building that trusting relationship, investing in a relationship, a covenantal relationship between us corporately, right? All of these are actually father adopting children, yes, individually, child, but also, as the Germans would say, childs or children, and spirit receiving a home. We, the body of people, we're each little bricks in the, or blocks in the tower, right? Of the home, the temple, and we, plural, are the bride of Christ together. So I'm very encouraged and hope we can continue to do that as we share with one another what has worked or what we think works, and those also go up and down in different times of our lives, right? Different seasons call for different times. There's always going to be birds around us unless someone pulls the plug and all of the birds actually die, right? Or whatever birds. I'm not actually sure what birds are. I think they're dinosaurs. But there's always going to be birds. There's always going to be things. There's always going to be sticky notes that we can put on. But maybe in different seasons of life, we need to do different things. And that's why I'm so grateful that we don't have, you know, this list of 613 commands, that this is how you have to relate to God. We have that as wisdom of how one group in a certain culture in a certain time did, and we are able, with the wisdom of the Holy Spirit, to flexibly adapt, and it's all about drawing near. So let's draw near in our prayer right now. Lord, yeah, we thank you that you carry us when we can't do it on our own. And none of these people, Gideon, Jephthah, Samson, none of these people, David, Moses, they couldn't do it on their own. We can't do it on our own. So we thank you that you do it for us. We thank you that you're a pioneer, that you're the author and the perfecter of our faith. Help us in so many practical ways and in one big emotional, physical, and spiritual way to fix our eyes on you. Thank you for this church, this community. Thank you for this 6 months of Bible school students, 107 witnesses, a great cloud of witnesses that encourage one another in how to fix our eyes on Jesus. We thank you that you cheer us on, that you go before us, and that you have the race marked out for us. We're not going to see it fully, but we trust it. And that helps us to not have fear, but to take another step forward. In your name we pray. Amen. Okay, it's a boys' sauna, I believe. And other than that, we see you at breakfast tomorrow morning. Have a good night.